Thank you for downloading the East Haven Podcast. For more information about our church, please visit easthavenchurch.org. Now, please join Pastor Kevin Reiser as he brings us this week's message.
Some of the most important things people ever say in their life are the things that they say just before they die. That's often been the case, and people have made statements and famous last words. Those are the things that you remember. I read a story this week of a man who was telling one of his friends about the death of his father. His friend offered his condolences and says, "Oh, I'm sorry to know that you've lost your dad." He said, "Were you with him when he died?" He said, "Yes, I was with him when he died." He said, "Well, you know, the last thing he told you is going to be something very important and something you're going to need to remember for the rest of your life. What did your dad tell you just before he died?" He said, "Well, Dad didn't get to say anything. Mom was with him till the end." But for those who do have an opportunity to make a final statement, it's usually pretty important. It's usually something worth keeping, hanging on to. And the last couple of weeks, we've talked about Jesus' death and burial and resurrection. And you know, there's a lot of to-do made about Easter. There's a lot of to-do made about things leading up to Easter. In the more liturgical churches, they have what they call the Stations of the Cross. I know some of you have gone to some of these churches in the last couple of weeks and have participated in the Stations of the Cross. If you do the Stations of the Cross correctly, there are 14 stopping points where you go and you contemplate something that's gone on during the whole process of crucifixion, and you ponder there and you pray and you think about what's going on at each of these 14 stations. That's all pre-crucifixion and crucifixion. There have been series after series of sermons preached on the seven words from the cross or the seven last words of Christ. There's actually a famous opera entitled The Seven Last Words of Christ. And so it's things that Jesus said, you know, while he was actually hanging on the tree. Those things have all been immortalized. And I got to thinking, you know, Jesus had a whole lot of ministry going on after he was resurrected. As we talked about on Easter Sunday morning, he appeared to his disciples several times in the 40 days that from resurrection to ascension, there was a 40-day period where Jesus did a whole lot of teaching. And so I thought it'd be fun for the next several weeks to look at these famous last words that Jesus offered after the resurrection, but before the ascension. And these are really his last words, because the words that he spoke on the cross, while they were powerful, they were not his last words. His last words of instruction to us came after the resurrection. And so for the next several weeks, we're going to look at the things that Jesus taught and the things that Jesus said after the resurrection, but before the ascension. Because once he was resurrected and once he did his 40 days of teaching, when he ascended, that's it. We've heard his last words until we hear his shouts of victory. And that's another subject for another day, and that's for a day to come. So for the next few weeks, we're going to talk about the famous last words that he taught in that 40-day period between Resurrection Sunday and the Ascension that happened 40 days later. And today, the famous last words that he offers to us is a simple phrase. Today, we're in Matthew chapter 28, and I'm not doing these in order that they were spoken. I'm doing them in the order of the gospel. So we're going to do Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Acts, and I'm just going to go through the books of the New Testament that way. But today we're in Matthew chapter 28, and in Matthew chapter 28, the message that Jesus wanted his disciples to hear is a simple one, but it's a powerful one. The message Jesus wanted his disciples to hear was, "I trust you." That was the message to his disciples. "I trust you." Now, I know that you're thinking, well, that kind of blows my mind a little. Why in the world would Jesus trust me? I don't know why he'd trust you, because I don't know why he trusts me. But that was the message that he gave. That was the teaching that he had. We want to talk about what he has trusted us with and how he has empowered us to get the job done. So if you brought your text, Matthew chapter 28, this passage is not new. I have preached this passage several times. It's one of our core values here at East Haven, and it's one of the principles that Jesus asked us to live by, not only as a church, but as believers. Matthew 28 is one of these command passages that's supposed to be a part of our life. So beginning in Matthew 28, verse 16, Jesus says, Jesus is fixing to say, "The 11 disciples went to Galilee to the mountain where Jesus told them to go. And when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. Then Jesus came to them and Jesus said, 'All authority is in heaven and on earth has been given to me.'" That's a lot of authority. All authority in heaven and all authority on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always, even to the very end of the age. Basically, Jesus says, I trust you to take my message global. I'm trusting you to take who I am and what I've done global. I trust you to do that. Now, you and I look at that and we go, it's a daunting task. But let me share with you how it can be done. If I say the word Coca-Cola, you know what I mean, right? I'm not talking about pop. I'm talking about the Coca-Cola, right? Red bottle, white stripe, you know, right? The image immediately pops into your head. I was going to put a picture up here, and I thought, I don't need to. Because when I say Coca-Cola, they see the bottle, they see the logo. Everybody on the planet knows Coca-Cola. You're like, preacher, you're preaching in hyperbole. Everybody on the planet doesn't know Coca-Cola. Yeah, they do. Let me give you some statistics. When John Pemberton invented Coca-Cola in a copper kettle in his backyard, he did it in 1896. 1886, not 96. 1886. And when he invented it, he probably had no clue about how big Coke was going to be. But in 1975, and then through the rest of that year and early on into the 1980s, the executives at the Coca-Cola Bottling Company decided that their mission was going to be to take Coke to the world. And so they reorganized the company and they started a marketing campaign that was going to take Coke to the world. Some of you are too young to know what happened in the 1970s, but I bet most of you know the commercial. I'd like to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony, right? And you got people sitting around waving candles and, you know, all sitting all in their little flip-flops and their hippie sandals and, you know, passing around the Coke and drinking the Coke. And all of a sudden, this huge campaign starts, and that's where Coca-Cola spearheaded this mission to take Coke global. The statistics I have are a few years old. They came from 2010. But a marketing research group did a worldwide survey on Coca-Cola. Listen to the statistics. 97% of the world's population has heard of the word or the product Coca-Cola. 97%. That's 7 billion people have heard of Coca-Cola. Even more astounding, 72% of the world's population has seen the Coca-Cola bottle and or logo. They can recognize it if you show it to them. From the richest of the rich to the poorest of the poor, 72% recognize the Coca-Cola product or the Coca-Cola label/bottle. Here's the one that really blows my mind. 51% of the world's population has tasted Coca-Cola. I'm not talking about Diet Coke and Coke Zero and Coke 10 and Coffee Coke and New Coke and all those weird Cokes. I'm talking about the original Coca-Cola product. 51%, 3.5 billion people have sampled Coca-Cola. 1.6 billion Cokes are sold per day in the world. So when we as Christians sit around and read this passage in Matthew where Jesus says, I want you to go and I want you to take my gospel, I want you to take my good news to the world, we sit back and go, man, it really can't be done. And Coke says, yeah, it can. We did it. You say, well, they have marketing and they have... That's true. All we have is word of mouth. But I promise you there are more Christ followers in the world than there are Coca-Cola employees in the world. And if the Christ followers would band together and make it their mission to tell the gospel story, then we could live under these words that Jesus said in Matthew 28, where he says, I trust you. I trust you. Well, how does he trust us? What does he trust us with? What does he trust us to do? Let's look at three things this morning. First, Jesus trusts us to live and speak with his power and with his authority. He trusts us to live our life and to speak with his power and his authority. He says in we're told in verse 18 that Jesus came to them and he said, all authority in heaven and on earth is given to me. Now, if you stop right there, you miss the power of that statement. Yeah, Jesus, we know that. We know that all power on heaven and on earth and all authority on heaven and on earth is given to you. John tells us that. We know that that's the case. But Jesus doesn't stop there. Jesus basically says, because all of the authority on heaven and on earth is given to me, and because you believe in me, look what he says in verse 19, therefore, go. What Jesus is saying in these first two words of verse 19 is that I have all of the power and all of the authority on heaven and on earth. Therefore, because you are in me, you can go. You can go and live your life and be my voice and my example and my witness to the rest of the world. Now, I hear your objections already, because these are the same objections that I throw up every time. I really don't throw up, but come up in my mind. Every time I think about this, it's like, oh, but you don't know how I sin, and you don't know how I have these evil thoughts in my head, and you don't know how I'm mean to people, and you don't know how I yell at my wife. And you know, if you really knew who I was and all the things that I did, you wouldn't be asking me to live in your power and authority. You would know that I am too pitiful and too weak and too tragic to live in your power and in your authority. Notice Jesus doesn't offer this up for those of us who are great excuse makers. He is talking to his disciples when he makes this statement. Who is in the crowd? Well, first, there's Peter. Peter's been a knucklehead for the last 3.5 years. People's mouth got him in trouble more often than not. He was always running off at his mouth. Jesus was always having to reel him back in. Peter was just a bonehead. Peter had just denied him 29 or 39 days before this announcement was made. And Jesus says, "I, because I have all authority, I'm asking you to go and do and be all of these things." Peter was in the crowd, and Peter was a bonehead. James and John were in the crowd. James and John were always posturing for positions of power in Jesus' kingdom. They were even arrogant enough to say, "Yeah, Jesus, we'll even die in bad ways for you." Their mom came to Jesus and goes, "Hey, I want you to make sure that my boys sit at your right hand in that day." And Jesus is like, "Do you have any idea about how you're going to have to suffer in order to sit at my right hand in that day?" It's like, "Oh man, we're willing, we're ready, we can do this." They had no clue. Boneheads in the crowd. I think it's interesting that in this passage in Matthew, it throws in, "though some doubted," right? You read this and it goes, "though some doubted." Well, the guy who doubted was a guy named Thomas. And we have been taught for years that Thomas means doubter. Thomas doesn't mean doubter. Thomas means twin. His name is, the Greek word is Didymus, and it doesn't mean the one who doubts. It means the one who is a twin. And so somewhere out there, there's another knucklehead roaming around who's probably a doubter just like Thomas is. But Thomas was a doubter. And the disciples had already told him, "Hey, Jesus has come in and we've seen him." And Thomas was like, "You guys got to stop pulling my chain. You must be out your box, because he's dead. I know that he's dead. I saw him die, and unless I can touch the nail prints, and unless I can stick my hand in his side where that spear went in, you guys can forget about it. I'm just not going to believe." Thomas was in the crowd. Jesus said, "As you're going from this place, you're going to go in my power and in your my authority." Who else was in the crowd? Mary and Martha and other women. You have to understand that when Jesus made this statement, and one of the things that gets overlooked is that Jesus elevated the status of women to a whole new position. Because women in the day that Jesus lived were considered just a little more worthwhile than goats or sheep or pigs. There you go. They were just property. But when Jesus spoke these words to these women, he elevated them to the same status as the rest of the disciples. He said, "Look, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Therefore, I want you to go, women. Even though society says you're not worth anything, in me, you have all authority. So go and live and speak and talk in my name. You have that power, that ability, that right to do that. And I'm offering this to you because I trust you. I trust you. I believe in you." Jesus knew who he was talking to when he said this. He knew the sorry lot that sat before him. And he said, "I trust you anyway. Because it's not about what you can do. It's about what I can do through you." And that's where we seem to miss the mark. That's where we seem to miss the point. But this is who Jesus was talking to. Where does that come from? How do we have that power? How do we have that authority? What does that look like? The closest thing that I can relate that is a police officer, right? A cop's on the side of the road, and he's writing a ticket to a traffic violator on Interstate 10. And he hears in his radio that there is a rogue 18-wheeler coming down Interstate 10, and in that 18-wheeler is contraband and fugitives. And he radios back and he goes, I'm just ahead of them. I will stop them. And so he finishes writing his ticket and he gives the ticket to the person in the car. And he sees coming down Interstate 10, traveling at, I would say 65 miles an hour, but nobody drives 65 miles an hour on Interstate 10. So at 75 miles an hour, he sees this 10-ton 18-wheeler coming down, and his car's parked there on the side of the road, and he sees this truck coming. And with ample time, the cop stands out in the middle of Interstate 10 and goes. And all of a sudden, you hear the squeal of the tires, and you see the smoke begin to billow out, and this 10-ton Mack truck comes to a complete stop. Now, the cop weighs out of uniform, doesn't have his vest, doesn't have his gun, doesn't have his bullets. He's not Barney Fife-like. He weighs 170 to 180 pounds just as he's walking the earth. What in the world gives a 180-pound cop the power to step out in front of a Mack truck and go, and have that guy stop? Well, it's the authority that is behind that cop. Because if that truck driver decides to squish the cop, then all of the Baytown police are going to come, and all of the city of Houston police are going to come, and then all of the sheriff's people are going to come, and then the constable people are going to come, and then the Texas Rangers are going to get involved. Heck, maybe even Chuck Norris is going to show up. But the reason the 180-pound cop can stand up there and go, and the guy slams on his brakes, is because the cop has the power, because behind the cop, he has all of the authority. Yes, you and I are broken. Yes, you and I are sinners. Yes, you and I have to depend on the grace of God to even breathe day in and day out. But even in the midst of all of that, Jesus says, I trust you, and I trust you to live and to speak on my behalf. You have the power. We're going to talk about Acts 1:8 later. Acts 1:8 says, you will receive this power. And the reason we have the power is because Jesus has all authority on heaven and on earth. Make sense? Jesus says, I trust you. I trust you. As the second thing Jesus tells us here, he says, not only do I trust you to live and to speak on my behalf, to take this message global, but he says, I trust you with my most important assignment. I trust you with my most important assignment. Jesus is really good about not leaving us floundering for what to do here. He says, your responsibility is threefold. Go and make disciples, baptize those disciples, and teach those disciples. Let's talk about them in succession. He says, make new disciples. As you live your life and speak in such a way, you are to create a desire for people to come to know Jesus Christ. Immediately people throw up the objection, well, I can't make anybody come to Jesus. I can't make a disciple. No, you can't. And Jesus never asked you to bring salvation to anybody. But Jesus did ask you and I to live in His strength and in His authority, and to speak in His strength and in His authority, and He would draw people to Him. So here's the question. Are you and I living our lives in such a way that we are a magnet that draws people to Jesus? Because our responsibility is to make disciples, make new believers, make sure people can choose to follow this man who is called Christ. Several of you use Oswald Chambers' devotion book. Oswald Chambers is just, every page is a brand new fresh quote that can change people's lives. On one of those pages of his book, Utmost for His Highest, Oswald Chambers says, no one has the right to hear the gospel twice while there remains someone who has not heard the gospel once. No one should have the opportunity to hear the gospel twice as long as there remains others who have not heard the gospel once. Another missionary leader named Oswald J. Smith said, we talk of the second coming of Christ when half of the world has never heard of the first coming of Christ. And I hear this week in and week out, oh, I just wish Jesus would come back. I just wish Jesus would come back. What they're saying when they say that, what I'm saying when I say that is, I am just tired of the hassle. I'm tired of the struggle with sin and with self. I'm tired of the struggle with humanity. I'm tired of the struggle with everything that goes on in this world. I just wish Jesus would come back. And I want you to know that from our vantage point, that's ridiculously selfish. Because if Jesus comes back today, there will be millions, probably billions of people that will perish because we haven't tried to take the gospel. We haven't felt worthy. We haven't felt trustworthy to take the gospel and to make new disciples. The second thing he says is that not only do I want you to make new disciples, but I want you to baptize those new disciples. Now, let me be very clear on this point. Baptism has nothing to do with salvation. We clear? You can't be baptized and then claim you are saved. Because baptism and salvation are completely exclusive from one another. Salvation comes when you make a conscious choice to believe in and belong to Jesus Christ. Paul says that is your moment of justification. Justification means that's when it's made like you, just as if you had never sinned. And so when you talk about being justified, it's that moment when you make that conscious choice to trust Christ for your salvation. Now, Jesus says there's some things that those that are saved do to show that they play for Team Jesus now. And one of the things that you do in order to show the rest of your friends and contemporaries that you play for Team Jesus is you choose to be baptized by immersion. But you need to understand, being baptized by immersion doesn't wash away anything except the morning's dirt. Okay? It does not wash away your sin. Jesus has already taken away your sin if you've made that conscious choice. Baptism lets those that are with you know that you are now an obedient follower of Christ. And to show you that I'm an obedient follower of Christ, I'm going to be baptized. And so we encourage people to follow through with that process. Jesus says, look, it's not enough to simply make new believers. Now you have to help those believers understand what it means to follow me. And the first step in that is encouraging them and leading them to understand that baptism is important, not for salvation, but for obedience. There's a third thing that he says we need to do. And he says we need to not only make disciples and baptize those disciples, but we have to teach these new disciples the truths of God. And this is where we also throw up roadblocks. We're like, preacher, this is where I got you. And I've got you because I do not have the spiritual gift of teaching. Therefore, I am off the hook. And I want you to hear this morning and understand this. That is a lie that the devil has sold you, and you have bought hook, line, and sinker. Those that have the spiritual gift of teaching wind up going into the pastorate or going into the seminary or going into the disciple-making business, right? But Jesus said that every one of you who claims to be a follower of mine is going to be a teacher. You're a teacher whether you want to believe that you are or not. People in this congregation are watching you to see how you live your life. And how you live your life is teaching them by example. People on your street are watching you and listening to what you say. And what you say and how you live is teaching them by your example and by your words. Your children are being taught by you. Your grandchildren are being taught by you. People in your small group are being taught by you. You are a teacher. It is by design. It is part of your God-given, created, built-in nature. You may not have the gift of teaching like Kevin, like Lance, like Jared, like Luke, like Jessica. You may not have that gift, but you are still called to be a teacher. And teachers do two things. They talk and they set an example. They demonstrate. And that goes back to point number one, where Jesus says, I trust you to be my teachers. I trust you to do these things. I know, it's just another thing on my plate. Well, that's where we have to understand that the process of being a disciple, the process of living discipleship out, the process of being a Christ follower is just that. It is a process. It is not a program that we put on the calendar. From time to time, I talk to people and they go, I want to start this new ministry or something along those lines. And I'm like, okay, great. What have you done to prepare yourself to start this new ministry? Well, I just have a passion. Okay, great. If you have a passion, then here's what we do. We start the process of developing that passion so that it has purpose, so that it has focus, so that it has intent, so that it maximizes its capability. Well, I didn't really sign up for all that. I just kind of wanted to get together and have fun. Well, that's not discipleship. That's just getting together and having fun. That's not ministry. That's just getting together and having fun. There's nothing wrong with that, but we need to understand that there's a difference between the two things. And Jesus says, I trust you to be those people. I trust you with that. I trust you because I believe in you. There's a third thing Jesus says here. He says, and know that I am with you always, even to the end of the age. I'm with you always, even to the end of the age. You and I need to know that Jesus says, I trust you to trust me. I trust you to trust me. And this is where we have these terrible feelings of inadequacy. This is where we have these terrible feelings of not being worthy. And Jesus says, my grace is sufficient for you, and there is no condemnation if you are my child. There is no condemnation if you are found in me. I trust you. I trust you with my assignment. I trust you to go and live your life in my strength and in my authority. And I trust you to trust me. There is nothing that motivates me more than knowing I have somebody that believes in me with all of their heart. It just revs my engine. It makes me feel invincible when I know and I believe that somebody trusts me and believes in me with all of their heart. That's what Jesus is saying in Matthew 28. I trust you. I believe in you with all of my heart. Two questions this morning. Do you believe that he believes in you with all of your heart? And do you believe that he really trusts you? Because until we can get to the place where we choose to really trust him, it's going to be hard for us to believe that he really trusts us. But Matthew 28 says, listen up, knuckleheads, I'm leaving. And when I go, you're going to have to go too. You're going to have to go back to living your life. You're going to have to go back to being my disciples. But you're going to go in my power. And I'm entrusting you with my greatest assignment. And all will be well if you will learn to trust me. He says, this is yours. I give you my trust. I trust you. There's a part of that that's really comforting. There's a part of that that's really scary. But in his humble sincerity, he said, my hope now rests in you, and I trust you to be successful. May God help us in such an endeavor, huh?
Thank you for joining us. If you'd like to speak with someone about how you can apply this week's message to your life, please call the church office at 281-922-5520. You can find more information about East Haven by visiting easthavenchurch.org. Remember as you go to live as God's people, telling God's story, building God's kingdom.